My name is Keith.
I'm Reno.
What's up? I'm Danny.
And I'm Patty, and it's all bad.
As you might have noticed, there's no more ads on this show. And that's possible because of Patreon and guys like you and gals. So please subscribe on Patreon. We got special gift for you, and tell a friend. Patty, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're stoked.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool to be here. Awesome, yeah.
We've been talking for the last hour. We're all out of story.
I mean, it was like a full-on out in the parking lot. That then a huddle of us kept talking in a big bundle all the way into here. Yeah.
We should start recording outside. Right. So by the time we get in here, then we'll have all.
I always feel that way, but like when you have fun, cool, interesting people, you always find a third gear.
You find a third gear.
There's never, we never run out of steam all the way.
It's cool to find out who we have in common too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know people from different places.
And, yeah. It is really wild the amount of weird crossover shit.
Oh my God.
It is nutty. Like I'm doing this thing at work with this other company. We're collaborating on this project. And like one of the creative directors, I jumped on a call, with them yesterday in the middle of the day. And he was like talking about business. And then at the end, he's like, "Hey, I noticed on Instagram that you're like running around with Dead City Mike." I swear to God, I was going to shout out Dead City Mike. And I was like, that's so crazy. Like I would have never thought that this, he's a cool kid. He's a Silver Lake kid, but he, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And we just started talking about Dead City Mike and how dope he is. Yeah. He's like, "Yeah, I met him through this girl I was dating and blah, blah, blah."
Yeah.
Dude, that's
but
cool.
You know him in a different way now? Dead City, is this a band?
He's in a band. You'll really like this band.
Oh, yeah, you would love him. Yeah.
There was an LA Times article last week where it was like the only dangerous band in LA.
Anymore. Oh, wow, okay.
Mm-hmm.
They call it like DIY punk, right? Because they just like basically show up and just like set up, plug
like generators,
in, light fires,
building
and shit.
A stage under the river and having a concert.
Cool.
They started playing during the pandemic when they started like doing these, like when everything shut down and there was no shows, and they started playing like outdoor shows. And at first it was like 100, 200 people where everything was closed and we were on lockdowns.
Yeah.
And they would come and all these like punk and graffiti kids would come together and come to their shows. And then people wanted to go do stuff, you know, people were like tired of being cooped up in their house. So they started, more and more people started coming out. And then they just released this documentary on kind of like on a bunch of their shows, but this one big show that they threw at the in Frogtown at the LA River, where like they threw this show and it ended up being they went and they like built a stage out of concrete. They've put a bunch of stuff to like
I think I saw something like that.
They found like bird scooters and stuff, any trash that they put under to build this stage out.
Yeah.
And then they played a show and it was like 5,000 people showed up. And
crazy.
And they posted the address an hour before they played.
Yeah. There's this houseless encampment over there.
Uh-huh.
And when we drive, we get on the 2, and every time my girlfriend will go, "Oh, look at it, it's romantic." Just outside. You know?
There's still times where I see it. Yeah, and it still seems so good.
I used to think that too. I was always like, I still will be like driving down Glendale Boulevard or something, and then there's like those lines of like Winnebagos and stuff, and they're all, they've been there forever,
and I'll think
that's what I should have done. Why, you know, like I have to go back and like maybe you know, like I didn't do it right. And that's always my thought too, is like, wait a minute, I'm going to do it again, but this time I need to add this one thing. And I'll be able
now the RV is like respected as
exactly.
your domicile,
so
they can't come in there.
Totally, I'm so a van dweller. Driving around in it.
It reminds me, one time I was in an AA meeting or an NA meeting, I think it was, and this guy was talking about how like, he was like a dude that, you know, did prison treatment and was like living a regular life now, and he was complaining about like how hard it was to fucking pay rent and take care of business, and you know what I mean. He's like, you know, sometimes I think back in the old days. He's like, an $8 bicycle inner tube, you know what I mean, or you know what I mean, having to pay rent on a two-bedroom apartment, man. It was a lot easier back then.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, any kind of bathroom with just one stall and a lock was great. You know? Uh-huh. Like, I had, like, a mental, like, little checkbook in my mind. Don't forget that Pioneer Chicken over there. Oh, yeah.
You know? So where'd you grow up, Patty?
I grew up in Seattle. Well, actually, like, in a small town north of Seattle called Marysville. Uh-huh. And it was all, you know, like, cowboys and farm and strawberry fields and kind of rural. Mm-hmm. And it was all, you know, like rock and stoner rock. Like, right. Not stoner
like
rock.
Like Lynyrd Skynyrd and shit like that.
Yeah, like Def Leppard.
Yeah.
And then we would, we do like have keggers out on the reservation, which is like that right next to the city is the reservation and the Tulalip Reservation, and the city cops couldn't
go
there.
Yeah, they got a casino there now.
Yeah, Tulalip. There's a casino. Yeah. And we would go out there to have all the kegs because, like, city cops couldn't go there. It was only, like, I think, like, state patrol, and they never went out there. Wow. So it was like we were, like, these crazy maps. You have to go left at this one, you know, tree that looks like an old lady. And then you go right up, and then you drive up, and then there's a rope swing, you know. And then,
so
and then you drive out, and there's a keg and a barn and stuff.
Would there be bands playing and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. And that's, like, I started playing in bands like that, you know.
Wow. Metal bands.
Like, well, just rock bands.
Yeah.
And then one time there's this band called The Accused.
Yeah.
They were playing, and I was there, and then they were like, well, do you want to play? You know, and so I, like, played some, you know. It was so weird, you know. It was like, you know, like, let the girl play, you know, or whatever. And then I got into my first band in high school, and then we would play at all these, like, you always play at the most ridiculous places, like, it's my punk rock band, but nobody else was punk rock at school.
Yeah.
You know? And this is like, you know, 84, 85. And you play at the Teen Rec Center, you know, then you play at in the cafeteria or somebody's.
In Marysville, still in Seattle.
Yeah, or Everett, you know, which is the next city. And, you know, you play at somebody's backyard and stuff. And one of these parties had all these really great straight edge bands. There's a band called False Liberty. And Christ on a Crutch, which had Nate Mendel, who's in the Foo Fighters. Mm-hmm. It was her first band.
Oh.
And there was like a half pipe, and my band played.
This is Marysville?
Yeah, it was like up even farther out in Mount Vernon, which is almost to the Canadian border.
It's so funny to me because all you guys we all think of you guys as all Seattle people, I'm like listening to the Mark Lanegan book now.
Oh, right, me too.
Ellensburg.
Great.
Yeah, Ellensburg.
Yeah, that book is dark.
And like Buzz is from nobody's really from Seattle.
Right,
proper.
Right. Some kids like Stone from, you know, Pearl Jam. You know, he went to private school and stuff. And
grew up
very
in
a nice,
like,
wealthy family. Yeah. Him and who else? Like Steve from Mudhoney. But then what's his name? Jeff from Pearl Jam. He was from Montana. You know, it's all these like locations around Portland or, you know.
But everybody kind of went to Seattle because that's where the hub was.
Yeah.
That's where there were clubs. Capitol Hill.
Right, Capitol Hill. Everybody sort of like went that way. And that's when I, you know, started playing. The more I played in these different little bands, then eventually I got to Seattle, you know. Like these all ages shows, which were rare because they didn't really have a lot of all ages venues.
Yeah.
There were some rules about that. But we play these shows, and then, like, the more I play out, the more people I'd meet, and then you're just in, like, playing.
In the mix.
Yeah, you're in the mix. Yeah.
What was the first band that really blew that grunge thing up?
Well, it feels like there's so many different, like, views, like, on what, but, like, I feel like
there's levels to it.
Yeah. I mean, like, Mudhoney was, like,
so
big, but then, like, Soundgarden, but I never thought Soundgarden was, like, that big of a, you know, but they did. But, yeah, it was Nirvana. That was the big deal. When that song came out, everybody was like, whoa. What's going on?
I remember, like, where I grew up. I grew up out by Riverside in a little town called Corona.
Yeah.
And there were, like, a couple of punks that I grew up with that were like kind of like the dudes who would like go out and find out what was up and bring it back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this one buddy of mine, Richie Boltzma, RIP Richie, he had a ramp in his backyard. He sold weed, fucking, he was like the hub, you know, but he was, he got hip to Sub Pop first.
Yeah.
And they started like talking about the dwarves and Mudhoney yeah. and all this kind of shit. And we started listening to all that stuff. And yeah, man, it was happening even before some of those bands went to major labels. Like right. they were yeah. happening.
I remember Bruce Pavitt, who started Sub Pop, was a friend, and he'd come to see one of my bands, and he had a night called the Sub Pop Sunday, and it was at this place called The Vogue. And in my mind, I had always had these like little goals, like I want to play this club and I want to play that club. And like when he said, you know, come and play my, you know, night
yeah.
at The Vogue, I was like, I've made it. I've really cool. made it.
That's cool.
And then we hung out and like listened to records. And he's like telling me about, you know, this is Mudhoney and they're going to be, you know, like, and this is Mark. And then, the, you know, like kind of showing me all the records. And we listened to, like, I remember listening to that first Pixies record. And
yeah.
like, he introduced me to a lot of really great stuff. And sort of made a brand out of, you know, Sub Pop.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like this. There's going to be like a singles club. And, every, you know, you sign up and you become a member.
Get a
and,
single and yeah. mail to you every month or something.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, is wow.
So when you're hanging out with those, I saw their docs. They seem really cool. They yeah. seem like a really cool crew of people that had like a really great taste in music and culture.
Yeah.
When you're hanging out with them and listening to music and stuff, are they partying? Are you partying? Or is yeah, it just chill? Yeah.
I mean, I was always the one.
Yeah, yeah, kinda, yeah.
You know, and I grew up in a house with no alcohol or wow. any. My both of my parents met in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting.
No shit.
Wow.
In Brooklyn
New
in
York.
The early 60s. And so they got clean and sober, you know, in met each other in the meeting, and then drove from the East Coast to the West Coast, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, had me and my brother. And so I grew up in a, you know, sober house, and I grew up in meetings, and I grew up with
oh,
the
wow.
language.
Wow.
So, yeah. and I kind of thought, well, I'm not going to be, you know. And yeah. then I thought, once I started drinking at 12, I thought, you know, well, they just don't know, I, you know, how to do it the way, you know, or like they were drinking liquor. I'm yeah. just drinking beer, and it's different, you know. God.
I mean, I will, it's so wild to me, like, that. Because, like, I, even back then, like, and, you know, I was on methamphetamine, but, like,
yeah.
all you guys, like, I was like, God damn, is everybody a junkie? Like, yeah. literally, like,
yeah,
right. like, when you think of, like, how many junkies were in that Seattle, it's yeah. wild. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it was, drinking is such a big part of, you know, we all drank, like, crazy,
yeah.
and it was always, you know, houses with basements where we could all like jam and
yeah.
you know drink beer, and those were that was kind of my crowd because they were drinkers. That's
yeah.
why I was with them.
Right,
and then
right.
in my search for you know to get even farther out of myself, you know, I landed on heroin, you
yeah.
know. I mean there it was I went to cocaine and I went to cocaine and alcohol.
Right.
I mean so many different chemistry
yeah,
experiments
yeah, for sure.
that
yeah,
we talk
yeah, for sure.
about. And so then, you know, and then once I hit heroin, it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I've landed.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. I'm yeah. the same
were,
way.
Were you
yeah.
already on heroin when you joined Hole?
No.
No,
no
right?
No,
yeah.
but I was a drunk, you know, and
yeah.
people always say, you know, you got on drugs because of that band, you know, or whatever. And it's no. I mean, I was a big drunk and you know, I used every kind of drug possible
yeah.
before that band. And that was even an issue, like, if you can believe it. Like, when I started rehearsing, like, Eric, who plays guitar in Hole, was like, you know, you drink too much, you know? And I
yeah.
was like, whoa, well, you know? And I remember he came over to my apartment in Seattle, and he comes in, and it's like 1 p.m, and I'm like drinking a beer, and I offered him a beer, and he's like, what? No.
Oh,
and
wow.
I thought that was the weirdest thing. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
Oh. He was like really focused.
Yeah,
on
yeah
trying
I think,
to like,
no, I don't want to have a
yeah.
drink.
Yeah.
You know,
like, what do you mean you don't want
to? So just to rewind real quick. So you're in Seattle, you're playing in a few different bands?
Yeah, I was
you...
playing in, yeah, I played in a band called The Primitives. And then another, like an all-girl band called Doll Squad.
Oh, that's cool.
And we played in Olympia. And that's when I met Kurt, was like around in that scene. And
the early lineup for Nirvana, there were four people in the band, right?
Yeah, Chad Channing was the drummer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I mean, there was even one earlier incarnation with some dude with a mustache, and I forget what his name is, but they played like Creedence covers,
oh, no,
you know?
Shit.
And I was like, what? You know, and then I saw them again. I was like, oh, that's the band that plays the Creedence cover.
Is that the dude who became a Navy SEAL or something crazy?
Oh, that's Jason Everman. He's a guitar player.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's so weird. He was like the extra guitar player in Nirvana for like a tour.
Yeah.
And then that didn't work out. Then he was in Soundgarden.
Yes.
And that didn't work out. And it was like, then he became a Navy SEAL.
Yeah. Right? He's like a gnarly operator.
That's dope. It's like, that's
no,
dope.
I think I'm going to be a Navy SEAL.
Right on, bro.
Later. Two great bands.
Shit. Wow. Not a lot of people in the Navy SEALs can say that, right?
They're
fucking Nirvana and Soundgarden.
The other thing that's interesting, though, to me personally, like every goddamn band from Seattle's good. Like, well, all the big ones that I know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
from
there was a lot.
Mudhoney to Hole to Nirvana to Mother Love Bone, all those bands.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam. And the Dwarves.
Yeah. The Dwarves are great. Yeah.
They're fucking hardcore.
And Hole was kind of an LA band, but had a single on Sub Pop. And so that's how I kind of knew of Hole. And the band, I was in a band called Sybil, and we opened for Hole in Seattle when Hole toured through in their first sort of incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the first time I saw them, and it was like, okay, that's cool. I like their single too. And then a year later, I'd moved to San Francisco and I was living there. And like right when Seattle starts to take off, and I'm like, I'm leaving.
Yeah, right. I'm over
everybody's
it.
Like, what?
I'm over it.
Yeah. Well, this girl I like is going. And I was like, God. And everybody's like, you made the wrong move. Yeah. But I get this call, and it's my friend Dylan Carlson, who was in Earth.
Oh, I know Dylan.
Yeah. And Dylan's like, hey, Kurt's his wife is in this band, and she is looking for a new drummer. So that's how I got into Hole, and then made a plan to go down to L.A. and from San Francisco. And it was actually on my birthday, which is coming up on Friday, the 24th.
Yeah, early birthday.
Yeah.
Nice.
And so I remember going there, and like I had this like shitty like tiny little car with my drums in it, and they were like, go to Jabberjaw.
Yeah.
That's where the rehearsal was.
Wow.
And like brought in all my stuff. And it was so hot in there. And I was sweating. Like, but I was drinking and taking speed. and
taking speed as in eating speed pills? Or
yes, pills.
Okay.
And then
crosstops or some shit?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. Tons
okay.
of them.
They were
like, they were like trucker.
Were
yeah, it was easy
deal.
To get.
Wow.
You know, and so I was doing that, and then, you know, Courtney comes really late, and Kurt comes in, and we're like catching up a little bit, and she's like, what's your, you know, what drugs do you do? Was like one of the first questions. And I was like, well, alcohol and speed. And then we played a bunch of songs, and it was fun. And, you know, and then it was
on. Did
you
already know the songs?
Kind of. Like Eric was like, here's this, you know, Eric was the kind of the taskmaster of the band. And he was like, learn these songs, you know. And so I kind of learned them. And then we just played just different things, and it was cool. We played a Wiper song, and I remember that was like one of the ones that was fun to play, and I had to learn all the old stuff, you know.
Did the Wiper song make the album?
It didn't.
Okay.
It actually made. There was like a box set that this label put out, and it was all of these different bands doing Wiper songs, and Nirvana did one, and we did one.
Oh,
yeah,
that's cool.
I've heard that record. I knew there was something.
But I
like
think,
it.
But actually, Carolyn Rue, their old drummer, was the one that played on that.
As a drummer, when you're trying to like, when someone says when you're going to audition a band, a band that's already fucking doing shit, and someone says you learn these songs, is that difficult to do?
Not so much. I grew up like playing to records,
yeah,
and so
okay,
you know, so. and then I'll make notes, you know, but yeah. there are drummers that are far better than I that will like be able to write shit out, you know, and okay. like can hear stuff and like play along to it,
yeah.
reading it, which is not my.
Who's your favorite drummer?
I like Budgie from Susie and the Banshees.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
nice.
And, and, you know, of course, John Bonham is great. And
yeah.
Clem Burke.
Yeah.
R.I.P. But
did you ever see that? There was this famous article where they're
yes, I know what you're going to say.
Neil Peart.
Oh, no.
They were asking Neil Peart. They go, what's it like being the greatest drummer in the world? And he literally goes, I don't know. You'd have to ask Karen Carpenter.
Yay. That's so
amazing.
Good.
That's amazing.
Really good.
What was the article that you were thinking
I was
of?
Thinking of the one where Clem was like had some kind of like face mask on and they were doing all these studies on like how long like the stamina and the heart rate of a person playing drums or it was like really interesting about sort of like your physical body and it was some details.
Oh, really?
Clem Burke was like part of that whole thing.
Yeah, John Bonham was an animal.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, plus, no he, shit, right? like, was so fucked up and playing. I mean, I remember the first like time, like, I started playing drums before I had my first drink, right? I was 11. And then I remember one of those parties, like, having a bunch of beers and then sitting down at my drums and, like, struggling to keep
try
the,
to play fucking
yeah, the stamina.
The
and
levee
then
breaks.
I realized what the difference was. You know, I really could tell.
Because it's exhausting,
wow.
right?
Yeah. And it's like there is no, you cannot, like your mind, your body is in a complete different realm, you know?
Yeah. And also, like the drummer's always the sweatiest one.
Right.
You know, you're like, God.
Right.
Right.
But then you begin the whole thing, well, if I'm going to drink, I better do some coke. You know, and then I better, well, now I should probably shoot some. That's quicker.
Yeah.
And like so many of those, like, oh then it becomes God. The crack thing.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. There was like a lot of times when I would get off tour and then go home and just be at home and like think I was going to be clean and like showing up at meetings and then just go, you know, I find
hit.
Myself. Yeah,
did you stay living in San Francisco once you joined?
No, I was. I went back to Seattle. So we're all living
because everybody's living. That's why I thought it was a Seattle band.
Yeah, we're all living in Seattle. Like Kurt and Courtney lived there, and then I lived there, and then Eric had a place, and our bass player Kristen, and so. But we were all like hiding from each other about what drugs we were doing. I mean, I kind of knew what Kurt and Courtney were up to, but like I was always lying about like, no, I'm fine. I'm not doing that, you know. But like. So fucked up, you know, and then
it's
like
tough. It's
trying
tough
to get my shit together before tour, you know,
mm-hmm.
That story, like if you're going to travel and you think to yourself, well, I'll kick a week before, right?
Yeah, of course.
And you never do.
Never.
And then you're fucking thinking you're going to bring enough to do on the road.
Oh,
oh my God.
It's gone after the second shop.
Like by the
stop.
Yeah. 2 days.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how much you get.
I know.
You make it to Portland.
And then all of a sudden you're in Philadelphia and you're like calling a cab. You're like, take me to a bad neighborhood. You know, like how do you say that to somebody, you know? Like
I would always look for the
methadone clinic. Yes.
Methadone clinic.
Me too.
Because then surrounding the methadone clinic, there's
always like one time. I called a friend in San Francisco and I was like, hey, Georgie, guess what? Courtney's missing. We don't know where she is. Do you know where there's a neighborhood that might have drugs? And it's like, oh, yeah, 16th and Mission. And I was like, okay, we'll go look for her there.
Just pulling all kinds of fun.
I was down there. In 2 seconds.
You guys toured a lot too, right?
Yeah.
It was a lot.
Yeah. But then, you know, there was a lot of downtime between like that our one tour, you know, and like towards the end of that tour was just a nightmare of like on and off drugs all the time. And
which tour was this for which record?
This was for Live Through This. Right?
Yeah, and, I love that record.
It's a great record.
And, you know, we did that Lollapalooza tour, and then we finished that whole thing up. And then I'm like, okay, we're done. And so I start getting high, right? I'm strung out. And then I get a call, and it's like, well, looks like we're going to have to play the MTV Video Music Awards.
No
and I was
way.
Like, no, no. And there's video of it, too. And I call up Courtney, and I'm like, do you really think we're going to do? Oh, absolutely not. Like getting her on my side, because if I get her to say no, yeah, then we're good to go. Yeah. We don't have to do it. She's like, yeah, yeah. And I go, what do they think? We can jump when they want, you know? And she's like, yeah, no. And then 2 seconds later, like we get up, she's like, I'll talk to Peter. And then so that's our manager. And then like a half hour later, the phone rings. She goes, Pat, we're going to do it. We have to. And I was like, fucking A. So we go and I'm fucking strung out and like.
Where was it, by the way?
It was at Radio City Music.
Oh, okay.
And
man,
like that is such a beautiful place to be. And yeah, what a lucky thing to have happen in your life as a musician.
Yeah.
But am I there for that? No. I'm like, I got shooting a bunch of dope, going down, you know, in fucking in New York where they'd lower the bucket. Did you ever hear about that?
I've heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah. You put your money in the bucket and then they raise it up and then they drop it back down and then you take, you know, like it's been one time it was a sock and I was like, I don't care. I'll put it in the sock. I don't care. And then, and then they raise it up and then you take your, and it's powder in New York. And so I'm doing all that and that I never forget it. It was that was those, you know, you hear it all the time. People say, you know, when the drugs stop working. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
And then how much I was doing, nothing could get me to feel okay about doing that show that night. Nothing. And I was trying so much and nothing would calm my nerves make me feel okay. And I got up on, we played the song and everybody in my band knew I was fucked up. And like, I remember like everything stops and like the song's over and our guitar player turns around and kicks like some microphones and they fall down on top of me. And I'm like, oh, you know, and I'm, you know, like running out of there. And like, there was stuff we had to do after. And I was like, fuck it. I'm not doing any of this press stuff. It was when Courtney had thrown a compact or something at Madonna. There was that whole thing.
Yeah.
So I was supposed to be in that little mix, but I was like, I'm out of here, you know, and like crushed. And so I get off the stage and I'm going through like, these places, these theaters have all these little, you know, walkways and hallways. And I'm going, I can't find my way out. And like, there's all these people. And I start to like go down this hallway and I hit this one section of a bunch of people and I'm getting the mix of it. And the crowd starts to disperse and I look and it's freaking Michael Jackson standing there. And he's got that mask on because he always wears the mask.
Yeah.
And he's wearing the mask and I'm like, whoa, you know. And I was like, I don't give a two shits. Get out of my way, Michael Jackson. I got to get back. I've got to smoke crack and shoot dope. And it was that night that I guess him and Lisa Marie were on the show, on the Music Awards.
They had their little kiss or whatever.
Yeah, they had to prove that they were a couple. Yeah. And, you know,
so
yeah,
crazy.
And I was like, out of there.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, that was kind
so
of
crazy.
Those moments of like magic that you wish for as a kid, you know, and then, but I thought that I wouldn't be able to play or to be like my ego would be, it was so sensitive, you know, and it was scary, you know, whenever we'd do, you know, especially with Courtney, who's so like, she's, you know, can be scary, you know? And for me, I was like, I felt like it was just a lot of crazy, you know?
And it was too big.
Yeah, it was really big. And then to not be able to really, you know, always just be quiet and just kind of chill. Yeah. And then, but then to allow, you know, like then to feel better, that's when I would, you know, started doing dope. It felt so much better.
People don't really understand, like at least, you know, these kids these days don't understand like what it was like back then. It wasn't like 90 million fucking Instagrams and this avenue of content. And it was like MTV and a few fucking radio stations.
Yeah.
And it was like, your band was massive and there was like four or five other bands that were massive. And like, you guys were probably in the spotlight everywhere you went. They were talking about who you're dating, what's going on, all this shit. So for someone who's trying to hide a fucking massive drug addiction.
Right.
On top of feelings of insecurity and all this kind of stuff. Coupled with the fact of like, it's not uncommon, I think, as addicts, you like have this goal and this thing you're trying to do and reach, and you work up to it. And then all of a sudden you don't have program, you don't have God, you don't have family, friends, or anything. You're just running on sheer self-will and fucking a habit.
Yeah.
And you get to it and you can't even fucking enjoy it. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's tough. Yeah. It's tough. You're not alone in that club. I mean, maybe in terms of, you know, the musical level you were at, but I think there's a lot of people that share that, you know?
And a lot of like, you know, getting pictures taken and like, am I too fat or am I like a body issues, you know?
Totally.
And then am I smart enough, you know?
Yeah.
And to know, like, to know, because I came from a home with a recovery, you know, but in my mind to know all this, but still say it to myself, well, I need this, you know, I need this. I can't do it without it,
full
you know?
On. Yeah.
And then to get to a point where, you know, the band's over and they're like, you're out of the band, Patty, you know? And I'm like, but that's my whole life, you know?
Yeah,
and
they
have no identity besides that. And then that was like, I'm downtown and I live on the street, you know, literally all of it's gone. And then because I couldn't, I'm like, well, now what? You know, I, that was everything, you know?
You had a doc, right?
There was a doc, I had a documentary and it told the story of,
I saw
you know,
it.
Trying to like, I guess, make it all kind of like in a shorter story.
For sure. Yeah. I'm like, let's roll the tape.
And I wrote a book too, and it was more details of like what happened on that path. But
yeah, and that was really interesting because at one point in the doc, you were saying like, you know, I just, to be closer to the connection. Like you just started like staying
right
down there and hanging out down there. You know,
because
you're down there closer to where the dope is.
Yeah, it's right there. So
and it's just like, and the next thing you know, you're like there.
Yeah.
All the
and
time.
Then that pain from, you know, getting kicked out of my band and that pain, I had to keep on using it.
100%.
Now,
isn't it, you know what's it's interesting about that? Because I always like, you know, whenever a band like is known for like a drug problem, like, when I was in Impact in 98 and I got there and Mike Starr, rest in peace, was in there with me. And Mike was like, but it was super, he was kind of in that position you were in.
Yeah.
And it was the wildest thing. So we're at Impact and I knew who he was, you know, I mean, it's like 98 and he's like, so whatever happened, you know, and everybody knows, you know, that whole band, he wasn't the only one.
Right.
And, but it was like, well, somebody's got to go. And they kicked Mike out. And I'm like, damn, but. You know what I mean? Like, they're trying to clean it up, and they're like, okay, somebody's got to go. So there's always somebody who's like collateral damage. And,
you know, it's never going to be the singer.
Right.
Never. It will never be the singer.
For sure.
Yeah. No, that's what I mean. But it's interesting. Like, you know, it's like the only thing that was like a real successful thing with the whole band was like Aerosmith. Well, they got them all.
Yeah.
Bob Timmons did or whatever.
Right,
and like, here's the deal. You guys are fucked.
That's who helped them out, Bob Timmons.
Yeah, because he was like the first intervention guy, Bob.
Okay.
He was the guy.
And Bob, like, and Bob was friends with David Geffen. And, like, Aerosmith didn't even have a fucking record deal. That's how fucked up they were.
Oh, wow.
That book was so good. There was a book, Backstage with, you know, or something. I forget what it's called. I just made that up.
Bob did the intervention. He put them all into different rehabs or something, but, like, the whole fucking band. Like, I think, or at least three of them. And then if they stayed sober, he took them, you know what it was? He took them to David Geffen, who Bob was friends with somehow. And David Geffen and Bob, like, the deal was like, all right, you motherfuckers stay sober, you got a record deal here.
Yeah.
If you fuck up, it's a done deal.
Wow.
So it was a weird thing, you know? But, like, otherwise, like, you hear it all the time. Like, there's always bands like,
he made all that sober music in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, and
that was the thing. It was like, you, like, I would, like, get sober for them. I would get sober for my band. They sent me to rehab so many times.
Totally.
And I'd, like, get out and go, okay, back at it. Let's do this, you know? And then the last time, it was like, not this time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But was there sober people around in like in the scene? Was there like guys like was there people that were like that you were playing with that were like hanging out that were like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I had sober friends, you know, but I, you know, I distanced myself from that, you know, and then I would just kind of hide.
Yeah. Well, it's always like, you know, when you're like, when you've been sober for a little bit and you get a little taste of it, and then you run in, you see somebody and you're loaded, there's nothing worse. You see them, you're like, you know, you like, just want to hide.
Joseph Brooks?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm like, I've got a stack of records, right? And I'm like waddling on into Amoeba, you know?
And this was at the end, like
2004 or five. And I'm like this, like full on crack habit and dope. And I'm in there with these records, you know, and they're like janky, you know, who knows? And here's, and there's Joseph. And I'm like, oh shit. And I like felt like there was a giant spotlight on me. And like, I was like, does he see me? Or, you know, and then I couldn't wait though. I had to sell the shit.
Yeah.
I don't even know if he saw me because I'm sure I've, you know, I've talked to him since then. He's like, no, I don't remember. You know, but I'm like, but you think, you know, and there's these sober people all around you, and you're like, holy shit.
Joseph Brooks is friends with my mom.
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
because, you know, he does the jewelry stuff. So my mom does one of the big, my mom puts together one of the big gem shows in Tucson. Shout out, Jogs.
She puts that together?
Yeah, she's been doing it for 30 years. No. J-O-G-S. One of the biggest shows. Yeah.
That's sick.
I don't know if she'll be stoked that I'm shouting at her or not. Or embarrassed. But, you know, but he, like, I was talking to him, and he was like, oh, I'm going to Tucson for the gem shows. And I was like, oh, my mom's been doing it for years, you know? And he goes, oh, who's your mom? And my mom is like, put the whole thing on. And I told her, he's like, oh, my God, Yelena, I love her. Like, he knows my mom, you know?
I think everybody loves my mom.
So then he goes out, and I get a photo, like, you know, a week later, I get a photo from my mom of, like, her and Joseph Brooks, you know? And then even crazier, so then, and it was, like, right after the fires happened, and there was this woman that came in, just came into the cafe, and we were doing, like, all that fire relief stuff, you know? Where we were, like, I think we did something like 30,000 breakfast burritos that we sent out to first responders, and then to people affected in Altadena. And there's this woman that comes in one day, and she goes, hey, I'm a chef, and I'm here to help, you know? I'm here to, you know, and I need to, like, and we're like, okay, cool, like, show up at 6 o'clock with all the other volunteers, you know? She had her knife bag and everything, so she was, like, legit, you know? Everybody else is just, like, people that wanted to help, And she showed up, and she was there every day, and she kind of, like, ran the, you know, was, like, would come in and would really hold it down and would, like, put people in their place and run stuff, and I get a photo, and it's my mom, Joseph Brooks, and her.
No.
You know, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and she was like, oh, I was out there, and somehow, like, I ran into Joseph, and he was like, you know, and we start talking, and I introduced him to your mom, and then my mom, you know, she's like, oh, my son owns this place, and they, like, sent me a photo of the three of them. My mom called, and she's like,
Danny don't like, know? Hey, Danny's always, like, the shining star with everybody.
Yeah.
Until his mom shows up, and nobody gives a shit about Danny. Like, Danny's all everybody moonwalking around the tropical. Aww. Danny's mom shows up, we're like, man, get out the way.
Step aside.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's what's really cool though is when you're kind of like in a circle like you just described and you all know somebody back home and everybody's just like glowing about that person.
Well, there's a weird like I mean, dude, there's such a weird connection. The Joseph Brooks connection is wild. Like you think like Patty, Sweet Pea, Valerie. I mean, because you know, like he's a lot older than Patty and me.
Yeah.
And like, but you know, he had like Club Fucked and Cinematic and all these great clubs, and it's weird, like
Vinyl
generations.
Fetish.
Yeah, Vinyl Fetish. I knew
his daughter.
Store.
His daughter Amra, and that's she.
Amra's like our age, right? Or maybe a little bit younger, right?
Yeah, she's like a professor of writing, and she wrote a book, and it's amazing, and
I probably know him from the.
Oh, you know him for sure.
Yeah,
he owned clubs.
Yeah, he owned a record store called Vinyl Fetish, and then he would do club nights.
But it was huge.
Yeah.
Oh, got it. Right. I feel like I've heard
back in the
'80s.
Yes, Sweet Pea. Oh, God, Aaron, Tom Moore's husband.
Okay,
they all worked there.
Right.
Nice.
But like they were like the fetish clubs. You know?
Oh, okay. Ron Athey was in there. In that mix, I think.
But it's generational because you know Joseph's like probably close to 70.
Yeah, and very good friends with Susie and the Banshees. Like
yeah.
Susie
first time Susie and the Banshees played here was at his record store, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because Joseph used to have a 2-hour show on Sunday nights on K-Rock.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah, but it's weird. Like, Joseph's, the amount of people that are connected to Joseph is wild.
That's a trip.
Because you have to think, like, she's in a band that, I mean, is like, you know, not really part of the Seattle scene, even though it's from L.A. But he has connections to, like Alison Burns, who's, like, in that rock and roll, like, a completely different rock scene, like the hair bands.
Right.
You know, everybody knows Joseph. It's so wild.
That's a trip.
So to have him run into you while you're clucking your records at Amoeba, that's the last person.
It's always,
That is the last person you want to see.
Yeah, the last person. Yeah.
Like, what you want to see is another dude fucking, somebody else with a box of shittier records.
And I, like, totally, I always thought, you know, I'd see Amron go, I think your dad hates me. Like, she's like, no, you know, because I like, he saw me once. You know?
But he's been there. Like,
he knows, of course.
We've been to, Camille and I traveled. Right. We went to, last year, we went to Indonesia, and we went to this island, Sulawesi. And, like, he's maybe the only other person that I know that even knows of this island, because he does these big trips,
bird trips.
Yeah, bird watching trips.
And we showed him, so we went on this, we went to this national park, and we showed him, we saw this bird, and he was like, oh my God. He's like, I didn't even get to see that bird when I was up there. He was all jealous.
Wow. Oh, dude, they came. That's awesome. Him and Gary came to my house, like, during the pandemic. I was like, trying to get rid of shit. I go, hey, come by and grab this suit, this Paul Smith suit here. Like, it hadn't been worn. You know, I'm like, and I got something for Gary, too. I swear to God, I live right around the corner. They pull up at my house. So it's like the pandemic, so everybody's like all distancey kind of. Yeah. And I'm grabbing the stuff, I swear, and I'm like, where the fuck are those two? No bullshit. I walk outside, both of them have binoculars and are like, there's a steel wing.
Yeah.
Stool pigeon. Yeah.
You know, I'm like, love that. Yeah, like, it's so cool. I love that. When people are so into, like, you know, like, Joseph's, like such a person who is a fan of music, but also into birds. Yeah. You know?
Oh, he told me he was at some dinner. I think it was, like, with David Stoltz and, like, the David Hockney people and all that.
Oh, wow.
And he befriended, like, this woman who worked for, like, I think it's Bausch & Lomb, who apparently make... Like, no, Swarovski, something like that.
Crystals?
Yeah, but they make the best crystals for the...
Okay,
for
yes!
The, you know, the binoculars or whatever? Okay,
I thought you meant
he was like, I had to be friends with her. She gets a 30% discount. I'm not kidding you. He's bananas.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So you're downtown doing your thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you go from, from the MTV Awards.
And... trying not to, like, even think of that. Like, I had to, in my, like, compartmentalize that part of myself, push it away and just, and so I did what you do when you live on the street, you know, like, and you're a girl, you know. I was a prostitute, I'll just say that. And also, you know, I had sex for drugs. I also, you know, robbed and boosted and, you know, I got to a point where I don't know if there was, like, one moment that just sort of, you know, came to me and, you know, said I was done with it. But I think it was more about, like, always being under someone's thumb all the time, always. Yeah. And
down there is a little wild, right?
Yeah, so yeah. And it, I wasn't able to be my, you know, like, I wasn't even able to, you know, like, at least when I had some money, I could... you know, get the amount of drugs I wanted and do them where I wanted. But when you have no, you know, no agency, you know, and it was kind of like at all to like, so I was.
The money goes quick too.
And it does.
You know what I mean?
It's just like a drug coupon. That's what I heard.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like a drug coupon. I remember I would be making, well, not your kind of money, but really good money for me at the time. And I'd be like, get here in 20 minutes. I'll give you another $150. You know what I mean? Like, you're just so jonesing. Money means nothing to you. All you want is fucking dope. Yeah. And you want it now. You know what I mean?
That like, I feel like it wasn't a lot of money, really. I mean, I didn't make a, I wasn't, you know, I didn't make, buy a house with the pool money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, to this day, I make a little bit in royalties. But, like, because I was the drummer, you don't, like, drummers don't.
Yeah, you're not writing the songs and stuff,
which
right?
is a whole other thing. Yeah. But, so, I mean, almost in a way, the fact that I ran out of money and I don't have a lot of money was the reason. It was like saved my life.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I agree with that.
Is it a whole other thing? Because like you're in the room and you're like, oh, I know you should say this and do this. And fucking at the end, well, everyone's like, no, it's my song.
But if you look at the big picture, like,
that's fucked
up. Think about this. Like, Patty's alive, right? Like, but like, Chris Cornell's not alive. Lane Staley's not alive. Fucking Andrew Wood's not alive. I mean, you think of like out of that, see, the amount of fucking like, the singers that are dead is fucking wild.
Yeah. And yeah.
Because there's nobody's going to say no to you. Not your manager. When you have that much money, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's endless. Like,
yeah, you just go through it. And then, you know, it's those cliches, you know? Like, you're going to run out of everything, and then you're going to be on the street, and that's what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and then I like, reached out to a friend. I got into Cry Help.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I've been to Cry Help twice.
Yes.
It's a great fucking program.
And
it's like a fucking Ritz-Carlton hotel after you've been living like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Am I right?
I know.
I mean, I was just running around the valley trapping, living in hotels and shit, like not doing the downtown thing.
Yeah.
But like when you get to Cry Help, you're like, damn, this is some fucking baller shit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But the then cafeteria,
you get
sober the
while
food.
You go back to speak there and you're like, damn, you don't right. have to touch anything.
Yeah. So, and, you know, Music Cares put me through, like, and they'd spent
Shout
money
out,
on me.
What's her name? They used to run it.
Winnie Wynn or.
No, I thought it was
Cherie.
Cherie,
yeah. But she's not there anymore. Yeah,
like twice before. And so a third time, they were kind of like, you know, and they did. And, you know, I went in and I had nothing. So I did the, you know, I got out. I went into sober living.
At the tea house there with Cryo?
I didn't do the tea house. I did it was all out in the valley in like Van Nuys, you know.
Wow.
And it was went to N.A., with all, and the women in my sober living were like,
tough NA broads
fuck
from the
valley. Yeah. Oh my God. And I fucking love them.
Yeah.
We fucking held each other up.
Yeah, that's good shit, man. God. You need that when you're that low down the totem pole.
And they know what it's like, you know, to talk about, you know, the stuff you talk about when you're shooting dope.
Yeah.
And they all knew it. And so,
the hustles you run when you're down there and shit.
Yeah. And
probably
so,
a really good way to process all that shit,
yeah,
too,
totally.
You know?
It is also, you don't feel like you're the only one
exactly.
anymore.
Right. Yeah.
That's
yes, that was such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're all, like, taking the bus and getting jobs. And so I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So I took the bus and got a job at a dog daycare facility,
hell
right?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And I worked, and, like, it was kind of cool to show up at, you know, 9 a.m. and then work all day and then get a paycheck and not – and, like, be able to, like, not spend it, you know?
Yeah,
and, like, then work my way up and then they're like, here's the keys. You can lock up at night. You know, they trusted me to lock up, you know?
Wow.
And I didn't, you know, steal their shit.
Yeah, you didn't use and, the dog drugs and shit.
Yeah. And so it was like it built my esteem, you know?
Yeah,
and I was going to
a.
meetings
that's
and stuff.
How you get – that's how you lift your self-esteem is through esteemable acts.
Yes.
That's what Alexis tells me.
Yeah.
By doing the right thing on a
my first
basis.
When I was in sober living, I worked at a market in Manhattan Beach for $7 an hour. I mean, from Pasadena to Manhattan
what
Beach.
What the fuck?
Every day.
Couldn't find a market.
Me and Mike Weiland both.
Oh, well,
wow.
I know Mike.
Yeah.
I knew Mike. We both went through Las Encinas together.
Yeah, he's been through there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But me and Mike worked together down there. And then we were PAs together.
Wow.
He's not with us.
No, he passed.
Yeah.
So it's Scott.
Yeah. Both of
yeah.
him and Scott, huh?
Shit, what a
singer.
Great guy.
Yeah.
What a great guy.
I did that same thing at Cry Help. Kind of relate to your story because I worked in fashion and whatever business, you know, and I came from a scrappy background upbringing, you know what I mean? And I finally landed this gig with this company and it was like fucking hot at the time. And we were like traveling to Japan and New York and doing these trade shows and all these, and I'm around these fucking people of influence. And I'm like, oh, this is fucking so cool. And I started drinking again and I started fucking around again, you know what I mean? And like, they tried to hold me up and, you know, give me little, you know, chances and stuff like that. And I had a very dramatic, kind of like you described your last, where they're like, no more. And I had a very public relapse, like, find the door kind of situation at a trade show in Vegas. And I did exactly what you said, where I just went and put a bunch of dope on it to not feel bad about myself.
Right. Yeah.
And I didn't stop putting dope on it until I lost my place in Newport Coast, all my stuff, all my shit, my car, my freedom, you know what I mean? And I, at the end of it, I was in the valley with a heroin habit and a whole new set of fucking tools to deal with life on that were bad tools that ended up landing me ultimately in Cry Help.
Yeah.
Thank God. But I too took the bus and humbled myself and I had worked for this big department store in the past and I had like a really good record of working with them 10 years prior, and they let me come back to work there. Now I'm taking the bus to the mall. You know what I mean? After doing all this fabulous shit, I'm like taking the bus to the mall. I'm using like clothing vouchers at Ross to get
humility.
Like,
is, you know what I mean? It's like,
and I'm there in the store, and like all the people that I used to travel with and ball out with and do all this cool stuff are like walking in there, and I'm in the shoe department like, hey, can I help you out with anything?
Yeah.
It was humbling, man. It was humbling. You know, but it helped me get to the other side.
It's those things, but you know what? Those little jobs, those like get well jobs, that thing. You know, it's like if you were to give me, you know, hey, if you were to here's a you know whatever, like let's say even a $70,000 a year job at that point, you know, I would have put it straight back in the spoon, back in the syringe, back in the pipe right away.
And the fucked up thing is, people did that for me after that because I had so many connections. Yes. People were like, here's a place on 3rd Street by Jones on 3rd. Like, don't worry. I just fucked
because we're
up.
All because us addicts off. We're little Cars. Magical people, and people fucking love us.
You're right.
You know, we are.
No, addicts and alcoholics are all 99.9% of the time like really charismatic, skilled, energetic, loving, connected people. But the disease and the booze and shit just completely takes that connection away from us, you know?
Well, I think, like, when you think of how obsessive our nature is, like, and there's no really doubt of it. When you think, like, every one of us, like, everybody we know tends to be really good at what they do when they're sober. Because, like, it's all this house pet energy focused into something good. You know what I mean? Yeah,
totally, totally.
Like, look at what Danny's done with the Tropical, or, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, my God. So I was living down the street from Tropical. I had a little place like a few blocks away, and I would go cop. There used to be like I would go down to Skid Row. There was a guy that I met at the methadone clinic that was like, hey, like I would try to cop out there because I was always like, the dope down at Skid Row wasn't good, you know? It was you know, everybody knows that.
Yes.
You know? Like, it wasn't good, but it was cheap and you get it. And he was like, he was like, and you know, and I would always be like worried that I'd get robbed down there, which a lot of the time I would, you know, or I would get like a bag like with some bird doo-doo in it with some soap, whatever. So I ran into this kid and he was like, hey, he's like, you got to go down. I think his name was Cliff and I think he passed away. He would always have a guitar with him, you know? And I was like, dude, like, and he never clucked it, which was always crazy to me. And I was like, just cluck that thing, you know?
Yeah.
But he was like, he was a busker. So he would always like, you know, he needed that. It was one of his tools, tool of the trade. And he was like, oh, you go to the VA and you could get dope at the VA at the methadone clinic outside that was right next to the federal jail. Like that shares a wall with it.
No way.
So we would be out there in the morning copping with literally like people like next door to the federal to the federal jail.
Right, oh, right Alameda there on one. Alameda. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow.
And so I would take the bus down there and I would cop and I would get back and I would get money from everybody. I'd get money from everybody, and I would go and cop, and then come back. But you know, it was like before I made it back to the house, I would always, you know, you have to pinch everybody's bag, take your little piece. So I would stop at Tropical.
People would always be like, heroin doesn't come like this. Like, it's always like sealed, like fucking Fort Knox. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like my shit would come in a piece of a shopping bag wrapped up in foil in a balloon.
Yeah.
But then I'd get there, and it'd be open.
Of course, that's me. Yeah, I would always, you know. And so I would always stop at Tropical and I'd be like, oh, I could go into the bathroom and I would pick, you know, I would get a little get well in.
Yeah.
And then I'd get a little get well and I could pinch everybody's. And then I literally lived 2 blocks away, but it was like my pit stop, you know, I was off the bus. It was perfect. And I knew, you know, I knew Donato, the former owner, rest in peace. I knew enough people in the meetings and I go in there one time and I'm like, all right, I'm just going to do a little dope. I pinched everybody's and I'm just going to do a little dope. And like next thing I know, I'm being walked at, like, you know, paramedics are like pulling me out while, and I don't know if you remember, but the bathroom used to be attached to the meeting room.
Yes. Oh,
so I'm getting dragged out of a meeting, like while a morning meeting too, you know, it's like people are on their way to work, you know? And I come back in, you know, and I would get sober and I'd come back and Donato, the owner, looks at me and he was like, Donnie, he's like, you can come to the meeting, you can come to the cafe. He goes, but please don't come to the bathroom. He's like, please don't come to the bathroom, you know? And what's crazy is the first financial, so I went into treatment and I got a little job. Like I was at the treatment center that we worked at that I went through. And I was like, I had an internship there and I would work whatever, you know? And I think what did they pay you? It would go towards your,
microloan.
No, I never got a microloan, which I fucked up. I should have gotten one. I missed out. Yeah, everybody would get these microloans. I never got one of those. But I think you would like pay for your sober living, and then you would get like a check for $400 a week.
Something like that.
And I remember getting that first check and being so excited, and my sponsor at the time being like, that's not your money. You know, he's like, what do you, and I was like, what do you mean that's not my money? It's a check in my name. This says my, you know, and he was like, oh no. He goes, what about all those amends you have to make? You know? And I was like, and I'd never made any amends. And he was like, well, who do you got on this? You know, he's like, pull up in the list. And we looked, and the first, there was an NA noon meeting that I stole money from at the, that I, from the Seventh Tradition at the Tropical. And he goes, okay, why don't you go make that one? He goes, and who else is around there that you stole from? And I was like, well, I also, you know, the owner Donato used to feed me and would, you know, and he would always, he kept a running tab. And I was like, and you know, so I owe him. He goes, okay, great. He goes, you can go make two of those. And I took the bus on, you know, I put in a pass and I took the bus, went there. I made amends to the NA meeting. Everybody's all stoked and, you know, they all clapped. Yeah. Because I'm sure.
Oh, you went in the meeting and like announced you're making an amends.
I made them amends. I made them amends. It was the Wednesday noon meeting. And then I went to Donato after, and I pulled him aside, and he was like so excited to see me because he'd seen me doing okay and then not okay at okay, and he was like, it's, you know, you see somebody and you don't know if they're alive or not. And I was like, hey, I got to tell you, you know, I was like, I don't know if you remember how much money. He goes, oh, I remember how much money. Because he would give me sandwiches and coffee, and and I made financial amends to him, and that was the first those were the first two I made, you know, and and shortly after that he passed away. But I got to do that, you know, and then like how crazy the full circle, like
Oh, that's like, so it's so wild. I mean, when we had Dead City on here, the drummer and lead singer came up in the game with Danny, and they ran the streets, fucking in and out of prison and jail, and just doing all kinds of stuff. And they're like, "This guy was the worst."
I was the worst.
To see him, you know, go through everything, and just it's just a testament to the program and the work and God and everything else. This is so cool, you know.
A funny Dead City story. So when they did their first music video, our friend Gilbert Gilbert directed it, and he cast Dylan Carlson in it. And so Dylan and I played detectives in this Dead City video called Meth Psychosis. You know, and we're going around chasing after them.
And I think he's like the last one of all the people we know from Seattle to get sober.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you think Patty and Callie and Renee, they've all been sober for fucking
ever. Yeah. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about my last year. I got clean and sober in 2005, and then, you know, 2008, well, you know, I met my girlfriend who became my wife, right? Mm-hmm. 6 months of sobriety, right?
Yeah, same.
That's how we do.
Same.
And then 2008, we get married because it's legalized. And then 2010, we had a baby.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then around 2015 or so, I'm at my psychiatrist's office, and my psychiatrist says, I'm going to prescribe Adderall. Because you have ADHD. And I'm like,
Yeah.
And so I went hard on that.
Oh, wow.
Right away with it. And then.
As prescribed or you took it?
Yeah,
more?
As prescribed. But okay. I did some things like, you know, calling up the pharmacy and going, this is, you know, acting like I'm my doctor, you know, and like doing like some really, and then pulling shit with my own doctor, like I'm going to Canada, I need to get an early refill, you know, like a lot of this stuff,
yeah,
you know,
dope
and
moves.
Everybody at that pharmacy knows, you know, they knew what was going on. And it got to a point where I started thinking about like, well, I think, you know, I need to get some kind of, you know, like, I think I should start taking, like, Percocets or something, you know, like, starting to look
level
for that,
you out,
you know.
You're trying to level out?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
And so, this one particular day, it was, like, April or end of March last year, I'm with my daughter, who's 15, and I'm taking her to her, a dentist appointment, and she's like, you know, she's just being a 15-year-old. She's like, Mom, we have time before the appointment. Can we just go to Starbucks? And I was like 2 days off Adderall and like stretched, you know, where I'm like, I have no patience. And I'm like, fuck, you know, and like turn the car around to go to like, fine, we'll go to Starbucks, you know, and turn the car around and like pull into the, and she's like, what's going on? And then I just fucking started crying, you know? And like, I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't lie to my partner. I couldn't lie to my family. And like also operating in sober spaces and being a liar,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I called home and my partner, thank God, Steph, is, our thing together was we both have the same amount of time. We had 20 years, you know, but not this person. Mm-hmm. And then, so we, you know, I get home and she's like, it's okay. I'll take care of B. That's my daughter. And so I reached out to Nicole and she was like, she was there for me. And I had such a thing about having all this time,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that happens.
And then, but then like my first meeting, I fucking stood, you know, I have, raised my hand as a newcomer and it just felt okay. You know, finally I'm honest.
Probably a relief.
Yeah. And like trying to unravel the lies, like, wait a minute, how much time do I have? Or what did I say to this person? And how, you know, it was like a tapestry I'd woven.
It's funny when you have, when you have time. Yeah. Like I still to this day have dreams where I relapsed.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, and I'm like, and I can't quite explain it, but in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm new. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like in the dream.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reality is
I can never fix. I got the
Me too. I do that too. I'm like, it's broken in my pocket.
Totally same.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I'm trying to like get this foil and it's like fucking not burning. And yeah. I'm like, so fucking
still
up.
To this day.
But we all forget it's fucking one day.
Yeah.
All it is a bunch of one days together.
You know what someone from Cry Help said one time that killed me? He said, at midnight, we're all tied for first place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I just had 1 year on April
1st. That's great. Wow. Happy birthday.
Okay.
And, you know, I some people can take it and take, you know, stimulants and be cool with it. But
No.
Thank God it didn't lead you to dope, though.
But it was going to go there.
Yeah.
And it's like I'd built my life up. I'd built this sort of safety net of things around me that, well, I've got that. You know, I can't. You know, like, you know, I don't want to lose that, but, you know, I don't know. I tried to build this sort of buffer around so that I wouldn't get back to the street, you know?
Right.
And it was you're probably there. Successful. I mean, you're clearly successful in that, you know, which is, right, it's growth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's growth, right?
But not showing up to meetings, not doing any steps.
Yeah.
And not, like, I had such a, it was,
I mean, Adderall's basically speed, right?
Yeah, that's all it is. Day, and for me, but I'm a person that I can go to sleep anywhere. I mean, like, I'm more, like, prone to sleeping than I am for any, like, so I was like, this is great. The speed, all the speed. You know, and, like, and it's, and the doctor said it was fine. I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then to come off of that and then go through brain fog and then, like, be, you know, you know, thinking back on how many times I kicked dope and then you think about like, wow, if I'm having such a hard time, you know, coming off of this, I mean, imagine what it would be like. Not that I, you know, would ever want to wish it upon, but to like, it's just like my body is like, and my brain, I'm like just getting my shit together in my mind, you know?
No, I remember becoming a slave to like, getting strung out on Norcos after having a little bit of time. The time I was in Cry Help, I got out and I moved back in with an ex on the west side. And it was just like, and then somehow or another, I just started chipping Norcos.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like up to 15 a day, you know what I mean? And I'm like, I'm strung out and I'm like, I can't not do them. And I'm in a meeting on the west side that's like, you have to have 10 years to speak. It's like an old timers meeting. And I'm just like sweating in there.
Yeah.
At the end of my work day, just like fucking. And you're just like, I'm going to take 2 in the morning, 1 tomorrow afternoon. And you have these plans. And how you're going to get off.
Oh my God, the plans.
And you're just like, it's never going to fucking happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I ended up back on dope.
And I'm like, oh my God, at this age, I'm still doing this shit.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Totally.
Totally.
What are you doing now, Patty?
What
are you doing now?
What, like musically or like with, well, not a lot really. You know, I did a score for Dustin Lance Black is a film director and a writer. He did that Sean Penn movie Milk, and he did a lot
that's
of
a fucking masterpiece.
He reached out and he said, "Hey, I'm doing a documentary about gay and lesbian people in the music business. What you know, back in the '60s when music, you know, rock and roll started, that were closeted. You know, like Brian Epstein and." Like the manager of The Who was gay, like so many.
Elton John was closeted.
Yes, yes, he's in this too. And I'd like you to do the score, just drums, all drums.
Oh,
and I was like,
sick.
What?
Oh, that's cool.
That's like so a,
yeah, dream wow. come true, totally.
What's it called? So
it's called Rock Out.
Oh, cool.
Wow. Oh, that's a great, that's a cool name. And I like
so, that. So I did that, and that was like such a like satisfying, you know, creative thing to do. And and like thinking about doing some music, but I like my brother who's also clean and sober, and he is a guitar player, and he is always like, "Yeah, let's do something." And I'm like, "God, I don't know."
Yeah,
you know. So like right now, I started. You know how you get certification to be a tech. Mm-hmm. At a rehab.
Yes.
So I started that.
The rat
and, oh, cool.
Yeah. That certification. And so I'm looking for work. And I'm like, looking for work doing that.
That's
and I'm
awesome.
Like, I'm gonna,
yeah, I can so, hook you up with some. Yeah.
Awesome. Because uh-huh. yeah. I keep, like, I've got one person who's like, we'll get you in for it. And I'm like, you know, yeah, I'm like really trying to spread a wide, you know,
for sure.
net.
Yeah.
This is a good place to talk about it.
Yeah. I worked in it for 8 years and, you know, and, yeah. and like, and that industry needs people that are good and that care, you know, because there's a lot of people there that are just, you know, that are like trying to work their way up or trying to get a paycheck or trying to whatever.
Dude, like,
and it's very, you know what? And it's like very meaningful and rewarding work. You
yeah,
know?
It and, is. And I know what it's like to be on the other side of it so many times, you know, like I know, like I've been the one dumping out the suitcase, like, I'm sorry, there's 80 crack pipes in there, you know, whatever, you know, and that person's like,
I checked into Tarzana, super sick. I woke up and I had nothing left. And the people I was staying with, like the woman of the house, made me give her my wake up in the middle of the night. And I was like, I'm going to treatment. And her boyfriend was driving me in the morning. And I grabbed a bunch of stuff from the storage unit I had in the West Valley, and I'm checking in, and this, like, essay was, like, an ex, like, essay was the, like, in the scrubs, you know, but he's, like, got the neck tat and shit, you know, and he's, like, going through my shit, and one of those, like, amazing, like, scientific speed pipes, like, fell out of my shoe, you know, like, the hard glass, to break, and there was, like, a perfectly packed bowl melted in there, like, no hits have been taken.
No way.
I still think of that bowl to this day.
Oh, my God. Because,
if you're a dopey like me, like, I've never thrown away drugs. Yeah. Like, only a handful of times when I really meant it, but, like, I've never, even paranoid, like, I just... And that thing fell out, and I was so sick.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, just let me take a couple hits off that thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he's like, hell no, I'll call the director in here right now. He's like, I've been sick before, real sick. You ain't sick. I'm like, fuck you, dude.
I know.
So pissed, you know?
That's the kind of shit that only happens to him.
So pissed off.
I mean, nobody would have let you smoke, but only Reno would get something like that. I've been sick.
Yeah, real sick. Like, I'm some punk bitch. You know what I mean? Like, fuck you. So fucked. Funny. But I'm sponsoring a guy that was in music in the 90s and came out here and fucking had a cool experience and and you know, lost it all behind dope and stuff. But he's sober a long time now, and he actually just got his rad teed, is trying to do the same thing.
Wow. Cool.
You know, yeah.
That's cool. For sure.
I think like the idea of like I gave up the idea of like I still like to play music, but it's like gotta let go of that like it's going to happen again, you know, or you know, it's like, no, it's not. And I'm good with that. And like my identity, it doesn't have to be that, you know?
Yeah.
And like, and if I didn't let go of that, I was going to die, you know, that person was, you know, still trying to get, it's like so much ego, so much ego and, you know, like all the stuff wrapped into it that was just, I have bad, you know.
Well, you touched on something too, and I want to just back this up real quick. So you touched on like that coming back and like raising your hand as a newcomer after having, you know, 20 years or 90 and raising your hand as new. And we have a friend that, I mean, just this week, you know, and what I would like, I'll say it, you know, Greg Foreman, who who just passed away, you know, who we lost behind this thing, you know, who had a little, who was in and out for a long time and who, you know, had a little bit of time and some, you know, some people knew that he came, you know, people knew that he got prescribed medication, you know, and was started taking the prescribed, and then came home from this tour and, you know, this big tour just wrapped and he started getting a little loaded and people found out and they did an intervention. And in this intervention, he told the people there, he goes, hey, he's like, I just can't raise my hand as a nuke. You know, I just can't let people know because I'm scared of the consequences. You know, maybe I'll get kicked out of this band and all this stuff, you know.
This is really a story.
And he didn't want to, you know, and so they were like, hey, you know what? Like, as long as you're, like, honest with the core group of people, it's okay, you know?
Yeah.
And who knows what would have happened, you know? But one of those things was, he was, you know, I know for me, like, I've come to meetings and I've been around and I've tried to hide that thing.
Me too.
And and he didn't make it, you know? We got a call two days ago that he passed away.
Goddamn.
You know?
It's the hardest fucking thing to do, right? For sure. But it's just like, you just described it, the relief on the other side
of it.
That
weight. I could still feel that weight being lifted when you just were, and it's like finally, like, you know, it's carrying around all these personas. It's like showing up as this, you know, and that. And like never knowing how to mix it up. For me, it was like the, like, you know, like when I'm like with my homies, I got to be this fucking tough guy, you know? And then like when I'm with my mom, I'm like this nice boy, you know? And then like when I'm with my girl, you know, or then like when I'm with the people that I'm selling drugs to, then I got to be like,
Hollywood,
you know?
Like, hey.
Yeah, hey. And then, like, you know, when all those things enter, you know, you're like, when you're like putting on these masks and you forget which one, and you, like, you know, like, I snap on my mom or I fucking, you know, whatever. Like, you come out a certain way.
You better not snap on your mom. I
show up with a black eye. You know what happened? Keith got me. But it's that thing, you know, when you finally just admit, like, oh, it's like a, this sigh that you've been, you know, this thing that you've been holding on to. So anybody who's listening or watching or whatever,
it's like, we're just like, without this fucking thing, we're all just holding our fucking breath. You know, when you think about, like, no matter what you're doing, heroin, dope, alcohol, I mean,
prescription
meth,
drugs,
hiding the whole fucking thing is just holding your breath. It's weird.
Right.
And then, you know what I mean, like.
Yeah,
I heard a speaker say, you know, this is so good. Where they asked him, they were like, he was like, you know, whatever. He was like, they were like, you know, he like sits down with the sponsor, and the sponsor tells him, he goes, hey, so he's like, oh, so long you've been sober? He goes, oh, about 5 years, you know. And he goes, and he was like, oh, he's like, where's your big book? And the guy's like, what's a big book, you know? And he goes, what? Like, that's crazy. He didn't know what a big book was, you know, 5 years sober. And and the guy goes, hey, he goes, I got a question to ask you. He goes, hey, he goes, how long can you hold your breath for? And he's like, what do you mean? He goes, because that's what the fuck you've been doing this whole time, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, you know?
That's crazy.
And it's such a great way of putting it, you know? Like, how long could you be in a 12-step program and not do the 12 steps, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, how long could you hold your breath, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was that thing.
The crazy
thing
is, too, it's just not, like, there's no perfect fucking way to do it.
Right.
You know what I mean? You just, you know, do some bullshit and write some stuff down, and you probably do it wrong the first time, and you're gonna, like, that's how I did it. I did, you know, with my first sponsor, I won't name him, he's hella cool, I love him to death, but we did, like, the Coors Light of steps, you know what I mean? Like, again, kind of just to get my privileges back in treatment, you know, just to write some shit, it's lightweight stuff. I mean, I had a cool experience with it, but I didn't have the profound, like, learning experience like I have now, where, like, the language of the book is, like, really, like, fucking hits me until I worked with Alexis at 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I really, like, read the book with him, like, a couple hours a week and just read it page by page and got through it.
I'm doing the steps different than I've ever done the steps in with my sponsor, Katie. And when I'm doing the steps, but then also in meetings, I started to hear the word freedom more.
Oh,
and I was like, I want to be free.
Oh.
I want to be free of, you know, and it's starting to get better. You know, it's lighter. It gets a little lighter. And then even, you know, I'm on my fourth step, but I've been in like 1, 2, and 3. And I really have got stuck on, I want my spiritual experience to be like drugs. Like, I want to feel it like that, you know? And it's like, that's not how it works.
Although, if you've never done breath work.
Breath
work. If you've never done breath work,
we were in the
same treatment center.
Yeah.
I was a little bit ahead of him, but one of the things, I mean.
Oh,
what happened to midnight?
That thing raised like Reno's ego. Huh?
But the breath work, you get high as a motherfucker off
right,
it.
Right, I believe it.
And then I feel like it changed the pathways in my brain.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because when I got there, I was really, you know, all I thought about was dope.
Yeah.
Hustles, making moves, da-da-da-da.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really came down, landed, was able to kind of like pause and listen to people and process information. You know what I mean? And it was mm-hmm. like through those, like we were kind of doing like labored breathing sessions or like, yeah. you know, 40 minutes mm-hmm. long, you know, to a musical soundtrack. You're like fucking, yeah, yeah. It's psychedelic for real.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I appreciated that because I too like drugs.
All right.
Yeah. John D, who actually is somewhere by here, you know, he's a breathwork practitioner. That's really rad. Yeah.
Was he the one at the FOTS thing or no?
Yeah. That was him. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. What's the name? Yeah.
Gianni.
Yeah.
Dave.
He does his with the cold plunge too. There's a bunch of guys that do it. It's rad. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Before there's two questions that we always ask, but before we get to those, all right. You have any good Jabberjaw stories for us?
Jabberjaw stories.
Or like, just, I mean, did you ever like, cause you did the rehearsal there, right?
Yeah.
Ever, like,
and no, I mean, like, just seeing bands there, really. Yeah. I mean, nothing. Let me think.
Why? Because Callie and them were
around. Yeah, uh-huh. They were around a lot. Did Renee tell?
No, Renee told me to ask you about. No, Renee did tell me to ask about, what is it, Everett or Evergreen or what was it? You know, where was it? He was like, what's the city?
Everett, Washington?
Yeah, Everett. He was like, ask him. He's like, tell her to have to talk about Everett. Yeah, but I don't know. But that's all he said, you know?
I don't remember.
Do you remember him from back then?
Oh, totally. Yes.
Did you get loaded with him?
And yeah. And but also he'll tell you what his nickname for me is and I hate it. And I'm not going to say it. It seemed like we were always out of dope when we were together, like you know, like scrimping and looking and trying to find it and like drinking horrible beer on the beach and I didn't really do a lot of dope with them, you know, but because we were always hiding, everybody was hiding from each other,
yeah,
you know, but
you were trying to hide you and the other music.
Yeah, well, like I'm not doing it, like, you know, yeah.
I don't have anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The only person I would get high with is Dylan a lot. And he would always keep everything he was always like, cool. Never tell anybody, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's two questions that we always ask. Number one is, did you ever try PCP?
No.
Never
tried? I mean, but there is this one time and it had to have been something like that. I was in Seattle and it was like, went to this fucked up crack house and like I remember smoking something and it was like crack, but then it was also like almost like a hallucinogen, but I was also like walking into walls and stuff. So there could have been a moment.
Oh, yeah.
You never know, you know? So it could be. You never know.
If you're doing bumper cars, it's.
Yeah.
Danny likes that walking into walls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had to ask you real quick, though, before you ask the second question. What was the heroin like in Seattle way back then? Was it just tar like it was here?
Yeah, tar. Okay. And it was great.
It was great.
It was great. You know, it's what you want.
Yeah.
Isn't it like, I think everywhere, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, L.A., I think the whole West Coast.
It was much better than L.A. But,
oh, really?
But in Seattle is much better. But then it was easier to get in L.A. because you could just drive down the street. You know, we didn't have that in Seattle.
Oh, really?
To the house, you know, and there was no one on the street ever in Seattle.
Yeah, were they tough on drug crime up there?
Yeah, but also, there wasn't like we weren't out in the park doing it, you know.
Right, yeah,
no. I remember the first time like I went down to MacArthur Park, and seeing, and I like literally like the way I could describe it is like seeing all the lighters go off. Like I thought it was like fireflies, you know. I was like, wait, what is that? And I was like, oh my god, that's all lighters. Like people just lighting up at night, smoking crack,
really.
Back when like Bonnie Bray was still like really active,
Fourth and Bonnie Bray. Yeah. I'm always a little bit curious, like what streets are going on down there. It's like, stop it, zip it right there. Let's wrap that up right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's so crazy. It's so crazy to
I hate downtown. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I do too. My kid's taking ballet at Marat, which is in Koreatown.
And yeah.
I keep not thinking I'm driving or like, and you know, I'll get off the 110 and take Will, and it's just like ratchet.
Yeah, like crazy. Totally.
And my kid's like, she goes, "Don't look, Dad. Don't look him in the eyes." She's real freaked out by him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's freaky. Too much. Yeah. I can't see those. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the problem is nothing's against the law, and it. I, in my opinion, I'm an ex-con, but like, at least if you put those people in jail for shit, they'll have a chance of getting sober. But 100%. What's going on now? None of them are going to get sober. Yeah, there's no consequence.
They don't get busted. Yeah. They don't get busted, you know what I mean? At all. Yeah. It's crazy. You see these like dudes with like, you know, full blasted up. That probably were just usually back in the day in and out. You know what I mean? And in there, they're running shit or whatever. Now they're out here in a tent, and you don't know what they're capable of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you people want. I never saw people walking on freeways. If you walked on a freeway, you would have gotten picked up and taken to, you know, either to put on a psych hold or just taken to jail for walking on the freeway. Now it's like, you know, there's another person. You know, now it's like the new normal. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I caught a case in Corona walking on the freeway. I had bought
this.
Where
were you going?
My car ran out of gas. I had this like kind of cool, like nice salvage title Acura, but I was out there on a good one, and it was like sun up, and I just like rolled down the on ramp onto the freeway, and my car just fucking ran out of gas, and I was running across. I was loaded, so I'm like, instead of going up and over and around to the gas station, I'm just gonna run across the freeway to the gas station, and right away this cop pulls me over. What are you doing? Get in the car. You're going to get killed. And I had paraphernalia on me at Riverside County. Yeah. They don't mess around, you know? Yeah. Brutal.
Yeah, before you would get popped for paraphernalia. Like, you would, like, you didn't even have to have drugs on you. You'd have a pipe. You have a needle. Yeah. If you had foil and a lighter on you, they would be like, all right, we're taking you. Or like, I had a straw one time, like, you know, with something, and they would just, they would arrest you for that.
Yeah.
Now it's like, you can be full on hitting, you could be shooting up. I've seen people shooting up in their neck on the street, whatever, it's, you know, so it doesn't matter. Smoking.
Where rocks, I grew up in Riverside County, if you were high, it was 90 days in jail. Mm-hmm. If you were not on weed, if you were on like meth or whatever, and they would like take you in, they'd fucking take blood or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it was aggressive.
Possession of methamphetamine in the 90s was a felony. Like, they'd arrest you, charge you, usually get dropped to a misdemeanor, but it was like a wobbler.
Yeah.
But like, it, you know, I got a 2-year prison for possession of meth and a firearm, you know?
Yeah. It's just.
And a firearm.
I heard someone say it once. It's just like, if you don't, with these people who are in crisis out there in full blown addiction, doing all these crazy things, just totally loaded, if you don't arrest them and throw them in jail, they don't have a break to have a chance to. You know what I mean? It's like the old system worked. You go to jail, dry up. Yeah. By the time you saw the judge, maybe you're out of your like little thing and you're like back to your normal self. And if you're just like, fuck you, you know, send me the joint, then that's who you were and that's how you rolled. But if you're like somebody who's just like in crisis, then they could see that at that moment and be like, let's get you somewhere where you can get some help. You know what I mean? But like, you just
and that modern meth is fucking. Yeah. Those people are—they're never.
I was gonna say earlier, like when you were talking about trying to keep it together in public back then when you were loaded, you kind of could because the drugs were good at least.
Yeah.
Like now, it's like just poison.
Yeah.
It's just they're just like, you know, trying to kill people. It's fucked up.
When you would go to see a judge, they would be like, "Hey, you're back here again. We can offer you this or a program," you know. People were getting, or like you would go back, or they would like send people on a court card to NA or AA or whatever. Now it's like, unless you get a DUI, you know, unless you get a DUI, we're not seeing anybody come in through the courts, you know.
Yeah.
And then people don't, like, people would come in through treatment, you know, like people would come into treatment and then would maybe not stay sober, but they would know where to go. The seed would be planted. They would at least know where to be able to find us. I came to meetings for, you know, probably about five or six years just to remember that when I would get sober, there was somewhere for me to go so I wouldn't stray too far. I would come to me. I was the guy that would, like, be like, I would, like, take other junkies or tweak, and I'd be like, hey, let's go to a meeting. They'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, come on, you know, like, because I would just want to, like, just be tethered, you know, like, to remember that there was somewhere to go because you forget,
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I had to go to drug classes, and I would get high and go to the drug classes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was like, and then, you know, court card, what? I would just make up my own shit.
Yeah, totally.
One of my favorite court card stories, I have a friend who told me this. So there was a guy that he knew this guy that basically came in, and this guy's, his dealer got popped, and it was his coke dealer. And the guy was like, you know, he comes over to get a bag, and the guy's sitting there, and he goes, man, he goes, I got to go to fucking these, you know, they always call it classes. I got to go to AA classes. I got to go to AA or AA classes or whatever. And to fucking, you know, I got popped. And the guy that he's getting the dope from, he goes, well, it's anonymous. He goes, why don't I go for you? He's like, I could go for you if you hook me up. And the guy goes, yeah, you'll do that? He goes, sure. So the guy gets, and he had 30 AA, you know, he had to go to 30 AA classes in 30 days, you know. So he takes the cord card, and the guy would go, he would take the cord card, he'd bring it back, and he'd get a gram of coke, you know. And the next day he'd go back.
Wow. For each meeting?
For each meeting, he'd get him a gram. He's like, dude, this is great.
Wow.
This
must have
been the 80s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't know about you could sign, you know. Yeah. So the 30th day, the guy comes, and he goes, and he gets a gram of coke, and he goes, hey, all right, I'll see you later. And he goes, where are you going? He goes, I think I'm going to go back to the meetings. You know, I heard some shit there, you know?
No way.
And that guy ended up staying sober. Yeah, he has like 10 years sober today.
That's wild.
Yeah. Which is like, you know, speaks to like, it doesn't, we never know. You know, like we never know when somebody, like he wasn't there trying to, like he was there getting a cork horn signed for his dealer, you know,
right.
to get a free gram of coke.
There's all sorts of motherfuckers who, they come with their friend, like, man, you got to get it together. And all of a sudden they're like, oh shit.
Yeah, right.
Maybe me too.
Uh-huh. You hear lots of people sharing that.
Yeah.
Patty, have you ever seen a ghost?
No. Mm. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Nice.
Never seen a ghost.
No. That's a good question.
That's our other question. I have another
question. Yeah, we are. Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah.
Danny has.
Where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah.
We had a when we had Blackie on, you know.
Okay,
rest in peace, you know.
Yeah.
And we had Blackie on, and it started this whole theme about ghost stories, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Is that where it started? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It ended up being like a Halloween episode that we did with Blackie. Yeah. Rest in peace. Yeah, Blackie was the coolest.
Man.
Yeah.
Man, every time we go through Chicago, call up Blackie.
Is that where they're from?
He would he'd get on the bus and then he'd, you know, give some for Courtney. And then I'd kind of call him over, you know, secretly, you know, and he'd bring some for me. And
That's awesome.
I mean, Blackie was awesome. maybe the funniest people I've ever met in my entire life.
Oh, dude, I was in Impact with him. And him and Mike Weiland, I mean, he would have us dying.
He was in Cry Help with me, too.
Wow. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, him and DH were there at the same time. Yeah, it was
both
like the drummers, all of us.
DH was with us at CRLA. No, I was...
He went through there, too?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. I think he had a bunch of time, but he had a slip. But he, fuck, man. I remember.
DH was, I mean, there's so many people, you know, so many amazing, talented, you know, like the, I mean, DH was like, you would see him coming and he would like light up the room, you know, just like,
totally,
you know.
Totally, totally. And he fucking looked 32, dude.
Like, I know!
It's so crazy. I was like, it's my sister. I remember mentioning my sister was an old punk who like, you know, worked at, she lived in San Francisco at one point and worked at Rough Trade Records. And like, you know, it was down here at a college radio station, was a DJ. And I remember telling her like she was a fan. I was like, oh yeah, DH is a friend of mine. I eventually went to CRLA and he was out. We were all working out at the Hollywood YMCA and he was in there just fucking chiseled.
Yeah.
He always had good, great cars too. I think did he have like a mint green Challenge?
He did. I lived in Koreatown. I was a few blocks away from him and anytime that thing was in the shop, he'd be like, hey, yo, could you pick me up? And I'd pull up in my little Camry. Callie gave me that Camry, you know? And it was a car that he had. And I would pick him up, and he'd be like, shit. He's like, the Challenger's great. He goes, but this Camry's running, you know?
That thing was always in the shop, dude.
Oh, yeah, always, yeah.
That's brutal.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think we're good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patty.
Thank you for having me. This was so much fun.
And what's the name of your book?
Oh, it's called Hit So Hard.
Hit So Hard by Patty Schemmel.
It's the same. Yeah.
Oh, cool. All right. And thank you guys for listening. We would like to thank the Archer Rivas Foundation for hosting us, for having us here. If you need help, if you guys are trying to get sober, or if you are sober and you're like coming up short on, you know, on EBT money, or you don't have clothes or whatever, like hit up Archer Rivas Foundation. We'll drop a link somewhere at this some point to reach out, and they're there to help you. I know tons of guys and ladies that have gotten help through there that are, you know, that are doing really great today. So and we're, you know, we're so stoked to be back. We're stoked to have this video and this great thing. We have a Patreon. We got a bunch of stories that we recorded as Patreon stories that we could not post because we were logged out of our Patreon account. As of last week, we're back in. We're going to post like 20 Patreon stories, but we need you guys to sign up and to help us because we are currently like throwing, putting together our change jars to get this to cover the cost of the studio space. Yeah. 100%. So jump dig on. Deep. Yeah, dig deep, you know. Hey, what's the saying?
Don't sneeze, don't cough.
Just break them off. Yeah. Patty, thank you so much.
Thank you
guys.
Thanks.
And we'll see you next week.
Right on.
Rap.